This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Folks, you know, I am all about those little pick-me-ups throughout the day. Whether it's tackling work tasks or conquering chores around the house, treating myself is a must. And you know what gets me smiling every time? Japanese snacks. Not only are they bursting with flavor, but their cute packaging and quirky vibes add an extra layer of fun. That is why teaming up with Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been such an absolute delight, because these are not just your run-of-the-mill grocery store snacks. Each month, Boxu brings you over 20 unique treats that you can normally find only in Japan. Plus, they throw in a nifty guide packed with info about each snack and Japanese culture. Snacking while learning? Are you kidding? It's like this was literally made for me. Oh, and each box ships free from Japan straight to your door. I happen to have a box right here, and let me tell you something. I loved the first box they sent so much, I told our ad people, please make sure that Boxu re-ups, because I gotta get another box of these snacks. First of all, check out this incredible guide here full of beautiful photos. It tells you about all the different snacks. You know, my girlfriend's gluten-free, so we can find one in here that makes sure it works for her dietary restrictions. But she's not here right now, so I'm going to make sure I eat one of the gluten-y ones. Ooh, 20th century pear biscuit. This delicate biscuit is a luxurious blend of 20th century Asian pear, rich cheese, and decadent white chocolate. Oh, it contains wheat, so that means I should eat it. All right, let me find it here. 20th century pear biscuit. Okay, here we go. Found it. 20th century pear biscuit. Cute little packaging. Let me give it a try. Oh my gosh. That is so good. Oh, the pear flavor is really strong. It's like a strong aroma. Next to this crunchy biscuit, the textural contrast is really wonderful. I mean, that is so good. And guess what? There are 19 other different snacks in here for me to try. I love this service so much. And you know why? My favorite thing about it is that they support small family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced these treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love Japanese snacks as much as I do, and if you want to try snacks that you literally cannot get anywhere else outside of going to Japan yourself, you have got to try out Boxu. Right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. Tell them Adam sent you, and now I got to finish these snacks. Oh man, that's really good. I'm glad she's gluten-free so I could eat this one.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I don't know the truth. I don't know the way. I don't know what to think. I don't know what to say. Yeah, but that's all right. That's okay. I don't know anything.
Hello and welcome to Factually. I'm Adam Conover. Thank you so much for joining me on the show again. You know, there's an alarming backlash against trans rights and, frankly, the existence of trans people at all in America today. Turns out bathroom laws were only the beginning. Now there are laws banning gender-affirming care for kids, requiring trans students to be misgendered, and even laws against drag shows in many places across this country. On top of that, there's a cottage industry of dumbass articles stoking the flames of the anti-trans freakout. And I think some of it comes from this perception that suddenly trans people are everywhere, that this is something new in our society. And I understand that to a certain extent. You know, 10 years ago, I had maybe met one or two trans people ever in my life. And now I have countless non-binary and trans friends who are living openly and who are thriving. And this is true across the country. The number of young people who identify as transgender has doubled in recent years. And today, 5% of people younger than 30 are trans. That is huge that so many people are out now. It is a generational shift. But the idea that being trans or gender nonconforming itself is something new that was just invented recently is false. See, we've been taught that the gender binary is natural, So we have this false idea that human culture and history has been based around that strict binary forever. But that is not the case at all. In so many places and times throughout history, humans have expressed gender concepts outside that binary. Take the Pacific island of Samoa, where there are four genders, or in India, where the Hijras are acknowledged as a third gender with specific cultural and religious roles. These people are not new. They have been acknowledged in the historical record since the 8th century BC. And these are just two of the many examples throughout history that challenge the gender binary. But it can be hard to see those examples or fully understand them from the limited historical perspective and notion of gender that we have today. So to walk us through this, to help us open our minds to the possibilities of gender throughout history, we have an incredible guest on the show. I read their book a few months ago. It absolutely blew my mind. I know you're going to love this interview. But before we get to it, I want to remind you that if you want to support this show, you can do so on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/Adam Conover. $5 a month gets you every episode of this podcast ad-free. We also have a lot of other great community perks as well. You can check them out. And if you love stand-up comedy, please come see me on tour. I'm headed to Portland, Maine, New York City, DC, Chicago, Atlanta, Nashville, Philadelphia, a bunch of other places as well. Head to adamconover.net for tickets and tour dates. And now let's get to this week's guest. My guest today is Kit Hayem. They're a researcher and writer based in Leeds and the author of the incredible book, Before We Were Trans, A New History of Gender. I cannot be more honored to welcome Kit Hayem to the show. Kit, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a total pleasure to be here.
I'm really thrilled to have you because, you know, we have a lot of authors on this show. Obviously, I hope people give me the grace to understand. I don't have time to read every book. But in this case, this is a book that I read before having you on the show. And then I was like, I have to have Kit on the show because I loved this book so much. It's called Before We Were Trans. And I think that, you know, our contemporary conversation about trans issues, about all gender nonconforming issues, is so much wrapped up in, oh, this is new, what a new change in our society, et cetera. And you demolish that in three or four different ways. Like, what do you think where should we start? What does the contemporary conversation get wrong about the history of gender nonconformity worldwide?
Well, I mean, one of the things that gets wrong is the idea that there is no history of this, right? You're absolutely right. The whole conversation is built around kind of, you know, central to it is weaponizing the idea that there is no trans history, the idea that this is a new thing, and therefore either we don't have to take it seriously because it's just a fad or a fashion, or it's a new thing and that's bad and we need to make sure we make laws to protect people from it because that's terrible. And so actually, yeah, really, really central to anti-trans arguments is this idea that it's new. And that therefore is incredibly damaging. And so really one of the main reasons I wanted to write this book was to get the conversation started about how this is very, very far from new. But I suppose what I also wanted to do was to open up the conversation about what different kinds of gender nonconformity and trans experience we might find in the past. Because I think, you know, there's a few little trans history stories that get wheeled out over and over and over again. And they're the stories about people who have really clear binary gender identities, who have really medicalized stories, really kind of classic canonical trans narrative stories of having known since they were 3 years old, and then they transition and then they conform perfectly to gender stereotypes. And that misses out so much interesting, messy, fascinating stuff that people have been doing with gender across the world throughout history, that it seemed a real shame not to tell those stories, partly because they're cool, but also partly because if we keep just telling a really, really narrow subset of trans histories, then we limit the ways in which people can imagine the possibilities of what we could do with gender now. We tell people, okay, well, the only thing that there's historical precedent for is this very, very narrow way of being trans. And actually, the truth is so, so much more complicated than that.
Yeah, I mean, you have some stories in your book that are the more the story that we might imagine, you know, as our first thought idea of a trans historical. Oh, here's a person who was, you know, assigned one gender at birth, and then they went to war as a man or whatever, that sort of story, and then lived that way the rest of their lives, et cetera, et cetera, under a sort of gender ideology that we would recognize as similar to our own. But you also talk about people who are gender nonconforming in cultures that had very different ideas of gender than we do, or at least differing ones. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was really, really important to me to write this as a global history.
Yeah.
Because it's a really effective way of showing that the way we have of thinking about gender now in contemporary Western culture is a recent phenomenon and a really locally specific phenomenon, actually. It's not the default way of thinking about gender. It's not the traditional way of thinking about gender that then people are deviating from. It's a recent social construct and a very Western, a very local social construct, just because, you know, we live in a world in which we take Western constructs as the default so often, doesn't mean that that is the right way or the only way or even the most common way to think about gender.
Yeah.
So instead, Before We Were Trans, as you know, is a history of different ways of thinking about gender and ways of experiencing gender in multiple cultures across the world, while also showing that actually in Western Europe and North America, there's still a lot more gendered complexity in the past there as well than we might expect.
Yeah. And you also, before we get into some of these stories, you also, I feel, are constantly trying to correct a mistake that's often made even by folks who are, you know, sympathetic to trans history and are looking for those histories. When they go back and look at histories from other cultures, there's a common error made. Can you just tell me about that?
So white trans people, and I say this as a white trans person, do this so often where we're looking for kind of easy ways to prove the validity of our own genders. And so we kind of seize upon these experiences from cultures that aren't our own. And we look at them through a Western lens and very, very rarely on their own cultural terms. And we also tend to do this thing where, you know, we say, okay, my gender is valid because look at India, they have the Hijra. And Hijra did not ask to be kind of instrumentalized for the cause of proving the validity of white people's genders. You know, that's not what those people are for. And it's really troubling to me when there's this kind of romanticizing, fetishizing approach to genders from non-Western cultures that takes no time to understand them on their own terms. And crucially, that takes no time to actually understand what those people might need, how we can give back rather than just taking by using them and then discarding them when we've made our point. And so that was something that I was really keen to try not to do throughout the book and hopefully succeeded.
And it feels like a missed opportunity to actually understand more about the world and about gender. If you are going, looking at someone else's experience, either elsewhere in the world or historically, and saying, well, what I want to get out of this is that it's going to prove something about me and my specific experience, you're going in with a real idea about it rather than saying, hey, if I really understand what this means to the person I'm talking about in the cultural context that they're in, what might I learn about gender that I have no idea about in my current limited frame of reference where I sit here in 2023?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a big, big difference, isn't there, between going in with a goal in mind to get something out of it and going in with an open mind as to what that interaction might reveal and how that might change the way that you might think. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of these stories. I hate to ask you this way, but do you have a favorite that you enjoy telling and starting with?
I guess I do have a favorite. I love many of the people I wrote about. Not all of them. Some of them, as we might go on to talk about, are not actually particularly nice people. But one of the people who I really enjoy talking about is a 17th century servant who was known sometimes as Thomas and sometimes as Thomasine Hall. So they were someone who was born in the north of England, where I am right now, born in Newcastle, emigrated to what's now Virginia in the US. And they come to prominence. The reason we know about them is because in 1629, they stated in a court of law, I am both man and woman. which is an awesome thing to hear somebody declaring in a court of law in the 17th century. And what it turns out they meant by that is they lived sometimes as a man, sometimes as a woman, sometimes as what they understood as both, and they had an intersex body. And so the reason I tell their story in the book is to talk about the intersections between intersex histories and trans histories, and how we might look at that in a kind of ethical way. But the other reason I love telling their story, there's two reasons, other than their kind of incredible defiance in that courtroom. One of the reasons I love telling their story is when you say this person had an intersex body, lots of people want to know exactly what that body was like. Now, even if I knew, I wouldn't necessarily want to tell you out of respect for the privacy of that individual. But actually, I don't know. And I don't know because the manuscript that tells us about that trial is damaged in precisely the place that would tell us what their body was like.
There's like, what, just like a little ink blot or like a little singed?
There's literally like a hole in it.
like it's a page we found in a video game, like we're playing Myst or something, and there's just, the one part that has the secret code is burned away.
It's absolutely incredible. It's like a real kind of piece of trans resistance in the archive, which I absolutely love.
That's so funny. It's so frustrating if you are a prurient historian who's just like dying to know about somebody's genitals in the past. Oh, the one spot. Funny. Why was this person in court to begin with?
They were in court because of fornication. They'd been sleeping with someone who we only know as Great Bess. We don't know anything about Bess. She was great, though, apparently.
Bess.
So they've been sleeping together. And then as part of that fornication trial, it quickly became apparent that people weren't sure exactly what kind of sex they might have had. And so then the focus very quickly became, what is this person's actual gender? And about a third of the town weighed in with their opinions on what was going on with this person's body. In the end, and this is the other reason I love this story, the court concluded, all right, you know what? You say you're both man and woman. Actually, we think you're right, and your sentence is to wear a mixture of men's and women's clothing for the rest of your life so that everyone knows you're both man and woman.
Wow. Wait, really? That was a sentence that a court could hand down?
Genuinely, yeah. So it was, they had to wear men's clothing, but with a female-coded headdress and a female-coded kind of apron to mark them out. And this is, it's really interesting thinking about this, isn't it? Because in some ways, like, if you're a modern non-binary person, for many of us, like, that's kind of a cool sentence. That's like, okay, you must express your gender. And, you know, so in some ways, presumably that was a bit affirming for Thomas or Thomasine. In other ways, what it does is it locks down their fluidity, because what they'd actually been doing was living sometimes as a man, sometimes as a woman, kind of hopping and changing how they wanted to be on any particular day. But this was saying, no, you're going to be static. You're not going to be confusing to us anymore.
And this is a time at which men and women's dress was obviously very, very different. And so everybody was dressed almost, I would guess, almost in close to a gender uniform. And so this would mark this person out as like, this is the town weirdo, right? Like everybody knows this person can no longer go back, or maybe they were worried about being deceived and now they can no longer deceive us, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly right about the way that clothes were understood in that period. And the other thing with clothes in early modern Western culture is that they were seen as something that not only reflected, but also kind of shaped who you were underneath. So like, that's why they get so scared about things like cross-dressing on the stage, because people are actually potentially going to be changing who they are underneath if they wear the clothes that are associated with a different gender. So this was also a way of kind of saying, okay, you say you're both man and woman. We're going to make sure that's true. You can't be a man by wearing men's clothes. You can't be a woman by wearing women's clothes. You've got to be both. And that's what your clothes are doing.
But I would have to imagine that if there was one, we have this one record of this one person in court in Virginia, you said, in the 17th century.
Yeah.
We must imagine that there were perhaps more people in North America, in the colonies living the, you know, with this sort of gender expression or identity. What does this story tell us about, you know, gender more widely at the time?
It tells us that people had the capacity to understand someone as both man and woman. And I think that's really significant because, you know, we said at the start of this, we live in this culture now where the standard narrative is, this is a new way of thinking. We've got to overturn our old ways of thinking about gender in order to get our heads around these weird non-binary people. Actually, all we're doing is going back to ways of thinking that we've lost. So in the 17th century, it made perfect sense for people to be like, okay, this person's both man and woman. We'll get them to dress like that then. And what that shows us then is it kind of unlocks a new perspective on the way that people across the board in the North American colonies and also in the British Isles where they'd come from, people across the board had the capacity to think like that. They had a way more complex understanding of gender than I think we normally give them credit for. So that one little court judgment shows us what could have been going on in a heck of a lot more people's heads, I think.
Yeah. And you also write about, with all of these cases, the danger of us, like, we immediately think, okay, I know all the gender identities in my life, right, that friends of mine have, or that I've encountered, or that I've read about on the internet here in the U.S. in 2023. Which one of those was Thomasine/Thomas, right? And you write a lot about the danger of that sort of thinking. How do you think about this person, just to get us started in that piece of it?
I've got to think about Thomas as both man and woman, because that is the only record I have of the words that they used. And this is quite tricky because on the one hand, this line of argument of saying you've got to talk about people on their own terms, that can kind of segue very quickly into saying, well, so you're right, there were no trans people in the past. And in a kind of absolute self-definition sense, there have only been trans people as long as people have been saying, I am a trans person. But what I kind of argue in the book is I think there's a really, really important distinction to make between trans people and trans history. So I would say Thomas or Thomasine, they were not a trans person, because that's not what they said about themselves. And I think an ethical way of looking at any other human being, whether they're dead, whether they're alive, whether I know them, whether I don't, an ethical way of looking at them has got to start with accepting the way that they understand themselves and seeing them on their own terms rather than imposing mine. And that felt really, really important. So Thomas or Thomasine was not a trans person, but I do think their story is trans history, because if we think about trans history as history that shows us that gender has never been straightforwardly tied to the body or straightforwardly binary or straightforwardly rigid or something that you can't play with, then that enables us to see, okay, well, if that's always been the case, then of course it stands to reason that we can still think about gender in that flexible, playful, messy way now. And that distinction between saying these weren't trans people, but this is trans history, feels like one that can allow us to navigate that really tricky line between saying there weren't any trans people in the past and saying there has always been gender nonconformity and there have always been people messing with gender.
I find that really beautiful. And I love the really thoughtful way that these are difficult issues. And I feel that the way you explain that was so thoughtful, but also understandable to me, very clear. It gives me the language I need to understand it. I also think it helps me understand the title of the book, Before We Were Trans, because transness as a word didn't exist before at this time, right? But there's still a we that goes back, that extends backwards. Do I have something right there?
That's exactly where the title came from. Yeah, it took a long, long time to come up with it. I think my partner came up with it in the end. But it was exactly what I wanted to communicate, was there is a continuity, not of terminology, but a continuity of community. A really important kind of strand of the book is sort of reckoning with the fact that we inevitably have kind of emotional connections to this history, and that marginalized people in particular, people like trans people who've been told that we don't have history and that we don't have community and there aren't many of us and we may grow up without knowing anyone like us, that looking to history for a sense of community is really important. And so it is really crucial not to just be like, well, there were no people like you in the past because they didn't use the same words as you. That, to me, feels like abandoning people in the present who really need this history as a sense of community.
Yeah.
Folks, today's sponsor is one I cannot recommend highly enough, Delete Me. As a Factually listener, you know how much I value online privacy. Well, Delete Me has been an indispensable tool for me for many years. I've been using them long before they even started advertising on this show. This day and age, it is shockingly simple for data brokers to peddle your personal information without your consent. These data brokers may be selling your name, phone number, and home address, and you might never even know it's happening. Trying to locate and remove all this data yourself can feel like an impossible task, but that is where Delete Me shines. Their team of experts tirelessly scour the web to track down and wipe out your personal data. In just 7 days, you will receive a detailed report of their findings. And believe it or not, a whopping 41% of Americans are vulnerable to online harassment, from doxing to scams and even identity theft. In some cases, having your info online can turn cyber stalking into good old-fashioned in-person stalking. Protect yourself from these threats with Delete Me. So if you're like me and you value your personal privacy, you want to make sure that your identifying personal details are not floating around the internet where anybody can buy them, well, you can get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/Adam and use promo code Adam at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/Adam, code Adam. I wholeheartedly recommend this service. Check out Delete Me. Today's show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Our lives are super demanding these days. I know that I constantly catch myself wishing for extra hours in the day. But here's the thing. The problem isn't as simple as lack of time. It's that we often have trouble prioritizing what's actually important to us, whether that's seeing friends, talking to family, or even kicking back with a good book. This is one of the ways that therapy can be so valuable. Working with a professional can help you figure out your priorities and make time for the stuff that really matters. And therapy isn't just for big trauma. We can all use a little help, whether it's learning to deal with stress, setting boundaries, or just getting stuff off your chest. So if you're thinking about giving therapy a shot, you might check out BetterHelp. They say it's all online, super flexible, and fits right into your busy life. You just answer a few questions, and they say that they will hook you up with a licensed therapist. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time, no extra charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/factually today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/factually.
So is there a person in your book to, let's do another story. Is there a person who, and forgive me, it's been a few months since I've read it, so I don't remember every story off the top of my head. Is there one that does a little bit more closely resemble what we would see today as a, we would say today is a trans person or no? Or are they all more interesting, complex stories than that? Even though none of them use that word.
Yeah. The answer is a kind of yes and no to that. I mean, so there are, you know, there are some 20th century stories of people, you know, who access medical transition and therefore do resemble our contemporary ideas of being a trans person a bit more. But I talk about those people specifically because even if they resemble our own ideas of being a trans person, they often didn't define themselves in that way. You know, some of them were like, actually, I'm intersex, because they have this different understanding of transness to what we do now. But I suppose I wrote this book because I wanted a space to tell the stories of the people who when you tell their stories, people go, oh, well, that's not trans history. That's just something else. Yeah, that's not trans history. That's just gay people, or that's just gender nonconforming fashion. Well, that's just the history of the theater. And I wanted to say it is those things, but it's also trans history because of what it tells us about the kind of malleability, the playableness of gender.
Yeah, there was one story in the book where, and please fill me in on the details, but it's a historical figure who there's a contemporary dispute about whether this person is part of trans history or lesbian history. Do I have that right? And do you mind talking about it a little bit? Even though I know it's maybe still, there's still some heated thoughts about this particular story.
Yeah, and well, you know, that's why it's worth talking about, isn't it? So I think who you're talking about is Anne Lister, who those who've seen Gentleman Jack, either on the BBC in the UK or on HBO in North America, will know Anne Lister. Anne Lister was a wealthy 18th century landowner from West Yorkshire in the UK, very close to where I am now, who has been treated for many, many years as part of lesbian history because they lived as a woman and had relationships with other women and wrote a diary in code, which was only cracked kind of more than 100 years after their death, which revealed these affairs with women and which showed really clear kind of self-consciousness of I am someone who loves women. And so a lot of lesbians, you know, really rightly and understandably seized on this of saying, this is someone with a lesbian identity, right? This is someone who is really conscious of, I am the sort of person who is attracted to women, which we hadn't kind of got very much evidence of people in their own words thinking like that in the 18th century before. So that's really cool and interesting. Anne also had an interesting and complicated relationship with gender and gender nonconformity. So they dressed in a way that was seen as masculine, and sometimes their partners found this really attractive and sometimes they didn't. They were given men's names by their lovers sometimes, and they wrote in their diary, and I think this is really interesting, they wrote in their diary about not wanting to be seen as a woman by their lovers, about it being uncomfortable when their lovers did certain things sexually, because then it made it seem like those lovers saw them too much as a woman. So we have someone who is incredibly important to lesbian history, and also who tells us some quite interesting stuff, I think, about the history of gender and perhaps about the relationship between gender and sexuality. And the reason I wanted to write about that in the book was partly because, you know, it's a neat example of someone who kind of speaks to both of these marginalized groups who don't have much historical representation today. But also because that really came to a head when a permanent plaque was erected at the church in York, in the north of England, where Anne married their long-term partner, Anne Walker. And I say married, you know, advisedly. It was a union that was not kind of legally sanctioned as a marriage, but was one that the two of them saw as a marriage. In 1834, arguably the UK's first lesbian wedding. And so a plaque was erected there, and there was a lot of wrangling over whether the wording should describe Anne as gender nonconforming, which was not a word that Anne used, but was kind of, you know, a description of their behaviour, or whether it should say lesbian, which also wasn't a word that Anne used. And it ended up with the plaque originally saying gender nonconforming, and then after a lot of backlash from lesbians who felt unrepresented, being recast to say lesbian. And what this feels like to me is a real missed opportunity to recognize that Anne Lister's story is a story that speaks equally to trans people and to lesbians, and the emotional connection to history doesn't have to be this zero-sum game where we're going, no, this person's a lesbian, no, this person's trans. But actually, if we think about it in terms of kind of feeling a sense of community with people in history, in our real lives today, we can belong to lots and lots of different communities. We don't sort of say you can only be one thing. And so it stands to reason that people in the past can also belong and speak to lots of different communities. But because partly because we live in a world where the political conversation is manufactured to construct divisions between different sectors of LGBTQ communities, I think. And partly also because we live in a world, you know, in contemporary Western culture, where we've drawn this really strict dividing line between gender and sexuality, which is actually really recent. That leads people to think, oh, well, this person's got to be one or the other. And the reason I wanted to write about all these messy histories in Before We Were Trans was in part to say no person is one or the other. And just because these stories are trans history doesn't mean they aren't also simultaneously other kinds of history at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like it's going back to a little bit of the same era that we were talking about also, where there's this effort to ask, well, what was this person really, according to our rubric, as though our current rubric that we've all semi-agreed upon, there's this type of person, that type of person, that type of person. Which bucket, which one of our buckets do we put them in without realizing, hold on a second, our buckets, we just came up with these buckets a little while ago, and 50 years from now, we might have different buckets. And rather than compete, first of all, why do we need to compete? But second of all, rather than putting them in one of our buckets, what if we just take what Anne Lister said as, you know, it's this is what we know. We know about them, what they said about themselves and the evidence that we have. And there's plenty to learn about from that. Right. And take her own words seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and maybe by looking at the past and seeing they have different buckets, we might think, are buckets even the right thing? You know, maybe we should be having like paddling pools Some other kind of more capacious receptacle that can contain more of ourselves. Maybe looking at the past might inspire us to do that.
Well, and we in the present, our own, everyone's own conception is a little bit messy as well, right? Of themselves. Like I have many, many queer and gender nonconforming friends. Very few of them are in very narrow buckets themselves. They tend to have, when you talk to them, a messy story of their own that is very interesting. And we can like maybe extend that same grace to people in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. If you ask any trans person today, it's very, very rare that we had the classical trans narrative of I knew when I was 3 and I conformed perfectly to all the gender stereotypes and I never had a moment of doubt. And now that I've transitioned one way forever permanently, I will be conforming to all the stereotypes of my new gender. And my gender is also just my gender and definitely doesn't have anything to do with my sexuality or my relationship with clothing. And we don't make those demands of cis people. You know, we don't demand that their gender can be perfectly separated from the way they feel about sex or clothes or roles in society or anything else. But we make those demands of trans people. Like, in order to be really trans, you have to be sure it's just about gender and not about any other aspect of yourself. And no human being is like that. Like you say, we're all messier than that.
Yeah. When you tell that story of Ann Lister in the book, I detected like a little bit of pain on your part that the story of the dispute in contemporary society, you know, was a little bit distressing to you. I was wondering if you could talk about why that is.
Yeah, you're not wrong. So I was a member of the committee that put together that initial plaque, and the one that said gender nonconforming. And I was working with various other kind of representatives of queer groups within York. What we didn't really realize at the time was that the consultation we did about the wording, well, didn't really necessarily reach the right people for like a variety of kind of locally specific reasons. And it also didn't last long enough because there was one of the community groups that kind of was keen to work to a specific timeline. I'm not going to throw them under the bus by saying who it was, but there was one group that resulted in it being a bit more rushed than it needed to be. What that meant was we ended up not really anticipating the backlash that was going to come. And some of that backlash was really transphobic and involved, you know, threats of violence, etc. Some of that backlash was not transphobic. It was just lesbians who felt really hurt. And that in a way was harder to deal with because it wasn't what we'd wanted to do, to hurt people. And it's taken, this happened in, was it 2017 or 2018? A little while ago anyway. And I'd been invited so many times since that happened to speak about it or to be on Ann Lister panels or to write blog posts about it or to write articles about it. And I turned them all down because I wasn't ready going through the real onslaught of online hate that episode precipitated. And it was only when it came to writing this book that I thought, okay, I've finally sort of got the distance I need from it. And also I've got the space to tell this in my own words and on my own terms and to talk about what I think went wrong, but also the fact that I don't think the solution that the groups who worked on it afterwards came to, where it just says lesbian instead, I don't think that that's a great thing either for Anne or for whole groups of diverse queer people today. I think it homogenizes and flattens someone who was actually really complex and interesting and whose complexity we could embrace more than we have.
Yeah. What I find fascinating about this is how important this history is to so many people, that it really, people got so passionate about it, occasionally, as you say, hateful about it if it didn't go the way that they wanted. But yeah, it's interesting when history is so present in people's minds and when it becomes a battlefield that makes you think about what history is for and who it's for.
I think it becomes particularly kind of emotionally fraught for people who don't get that much representation in history in a way.
Yes. And
like if you are any shade of queer or, you know, anything, if you are from any marginalized group, essentially, it's very rare that you get representation in mainstream historical narratives, or that you'll be taught histories that you recognize as being about people who relate to you at school. And so when you do find someone, you really, really cling to them. And we end up kind of fighting over them as if they're really kind of scarce resources, because we just haven't been given, it feels like, enough to go around. And this is why I think it's so important to reframe the way we think about it, and to think, instead of this person belongs to me and only me, and we have to claim them in this kind of capitalist way, to think instead, you know, okay, can we, how can we think about history as a source of community, and how can we think about being multiple groups of people being in community and in solidarity with these people from history without it taking away from other groups of people feeling the same thing?
Yeah. I mean, the history is a renewable resource. Everybody right. can, you never run out of people being able to see themselves in a historical figure and get knowledge and understanding from it. So, my God, this conversation is incredible. I cannot wait to keep talking to you after the break. We'll be right back with more Kit Haim.
Hey, everybody, I know we're in the ad break, but we're doing something a little bit different today. Today, I'm going to tell you about an amazing group of people who did not pay us anything to be a part of the show. We just think they do amazing work, and we wanted you to know about them. You might remember, back in 2018, those heart-wrenching stories of families torn apart by Border Patrol, refugee children being pulled away from their parents who were in turn deported to their home countries. It was devastating then, and it's just as devastating now, with hundreds of families still not reunited after all these years. You know, we discuss so many problems on Factually, but I firmly believe that there is always something that can be done about those problems. And recently, I came across an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. Since 2018, they have successfully brought together over 100 families torn apart by Trump's zero-tolerance policy. But reuniting those families is just the beginning. Al Otro Lado continues to support each family with legal aid, housing, and counseling to help heal and get back on their feet. I mean, can you imagine the agony of having your child ripped from your arms, unsure of when you'll see them again? We cannot allow such family separations to continue. So if you're like me and believe that all families belong together, then join me in supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today. You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website at alotrolado.org/volunteer. Thank you so much.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Okay, we're back with Kit Haim. You've been telling us these incredible stories about gender nonconforming people of all types in the past, but we told a story in Virginia, one in the UK. I'd love to get into some of the stories you tell about folks in other parts of the world throughout history. Do you have a favorite from all of the rest of the globe?
From the whole rest of the world. One of my favorites is the story that I opened the first chapter after the introduction with, which is the monarch of Ndongo in what's now Angola, whose name was Njinga Mbande. And I say monarch very advisedly, because Njinga was assigned female at birth, but when they reigned as king, not as queen. I wanted to tell that story because I wanted to think about the fact that probably the most common way that trans history gets dismissed is when people look at a story and they say, well, that's not trans history. That's just a woman making her way in a patriarchal society. So she had to dress up as a man in order to achieve the things she wanted to achieve.
Right.
Doubtless, those stories and those experiences exist in lots and lots of places. Njinga's story is different, though, and many, many similar stories from similar periods and similar places are different because Njinga ruled as a king because the role of monarch was male in their society. So when you became monarch, you became king. That's what there was. And to a modern Western ear, that sounds kind of regressive. That's like saying, what, there's no such thing as a ruling woman. You can't be a woman and rule at the same time. But you've just got to get your head around the fact that that wasn't a repressive value in 17th century Ndongo. And it remains not a repressive value in many, many cultures today. It's just different. It's not worse.
How so? Because I'm having trouble getting out of my current conception in, you know, 2023 US.
It's just different and not worse because if you don't think that one gender is automatically better than another, then it shouldn't matter that someone's gendered experience changes depending on the role they're occupying. You know, if you don't live in a society that says women are worse, then it shouldn't be a problem to say, well, being a woman isn't something that's compatible with this particular box or this particular role. Mm. That makes sense.
I think so, yeah.
The thing, I suppose, that also that complicates Njinga's experience, and this was another reason it was really interesting to research and to write about, was because they ruled as king in part because that was the way that the role of monarch was gendered in their society. But it was also a really strategically convenient thing to do because at the time that they were ruling Ndongo, they were having to negotiate with Portuguese colonizers. And the Portuguese very much did come from a patriarchal society. They were very much going to respect a king way more than they were going to respect a queen. So it's really, really hard then to tease apart, you know, what was going on for Njinga's experience. Were they just ruling as king because that was the way they understood it culturally? Or was there also a bit of them that was like, well, the more I look masculine, the more I'm going to be able to negotiate effectively with these people who want to take over my country? It is impossible to separate those two things. And the story of gender nonconformity in non-Western cultures is so often a story that's also about Western colonization. But what's really important to say is that's not always a story of just, we had all these genders and then the colonization squashed them. You know, sometimes that's definitely the story. But sometimes it's also a story of we have these gendered experiences and then people resiliently and creatively shaped them differently in response to their experiences of colonization.
Right. Like, oh, there's these new people on the scene and I can tell they have different gender ideas than I do. And so maybe if I present myself in a way that they will understand as X, whatever it may be, then I can accomplish the thing I want to accomplish. And that's okay with me because I am blah, 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 blah. And that's a far more interesting story.
Yeah, I think so. And it's also a story that gets away from falling into some of the traps that even if you're trying to write anti-racist history, you might fall into where you present people of color as primarily victims. And don't get me wrong, that like there are a lot of stories of victimhood and pain and harm in the history of gender nonconformity and its relationship to colonization, particularly in North America, I've got to say. But there are also a lot of stories of agency and resilience. Yeah. And it's really essential to tell those stories alongside the stories of harm, I think.
Yeah. How much do we know about Njinga's, you know, personal life in terms of how they presented themselves? Or do we really only have the sort of like monarchical history?
We really only have the history written by white Western onlookers. It's a real challenge in writing a lot of these histories is that the sources that have been preserved are the sources from societies with primarily written rather than oral traditions, which are often the oppressor societies, the colonizer societies. what that means then is you have to look at their records of how this person behaved or what this person did. And you have to sort of try and put yourself in that person's shoes and say, okay, we know they behaved like that. Why might they have been behaving like that? And try and reconstruct their perspective and their terms of understanding themselves kind of as best you can. But it's probably, you know, people often ask me, what was the biggest challenge in writing this book? That is it, is the fact that you're so often working with sources that were written by the people who are perpetuating the harm that you're trying to write against.
Yeah. Well, I can see how, given that sort of paucity of information about like the details, there's a lot that one can fill in one's own blanks in this story. Like, if you want to see this figure as someone who said, hey, this is a woman taking power and just sort of maintained that identity and put on the shoulder pads that, you know, women put on in the 1980s here in the US to be a little bit more masculine, right? I just got to compete with the boys, right? You could see that in this story if you wanted to, but I think what you're illuminating is there is a dimension of gender nonconformity that you can see as well. Do I have that right?
Absolutely, yeah. So this is another one of those stories that different people can find sensitive community with. So you can understand Njinga as an incredibly defiant woman, and that's really important mm-hmm. to lots of people and lots of women in Angola today. You can also understand simultaneously Njinga as a person who showed that gender was not determined by what your body was like. And that's really cool and really interesting and really affirming to lots of trans people today.
And instead is determined by the role that you take, the person that you act as in society, or something along those lines.
Yeah, exactly. So gender can be something that you do and not just something that has this kind of one-to-one causal relationship between your body's like this, so you've got to be this, you've got to live like this, you've got to be understood as this. And actually, the more you look at, you know, I said that we can often find these histories and these different ways of understanding gender in Western European history as well. If you look at around the same time, Elizabeth I in England, she was also being called king and prince and being understood as somewhat more male as a result of having a male-coded or masculine-coded role.
Really?
So it wasn't as absolute in England, but it was still something where gender was complicated on the basis of what role you took in society. Yeah.
Yes, I love that. Just the complication of it being the interesting part, that it's not a clear-cut story, as gender is not in our time as well.
Yeah, exactly. And all these stories are, you know, they take time and thought and feeling okay with ambiguity and discomfort in order to really get your head around them. And I think that's why, you know, they don't make good sound bites. They don't make good kind of political sticks to beat the opposition with, you know, but they are essential to tell because they reflect the reality of our own gendered experiences being complicated today as well, like we talked about before.
I'm curious how yourself as a white person writing in the UK, you know, when you're writing stories about folks from, you know, other cultures, other countries, especially places that were colonized by white folks, how do you try to, you know, get yourself out of that lens and, you know, write about them in a way that is honors their specific experience, even though you don't, you know, have that personal connection?
It was really important for me to reflect honestly about the difficulties of doing that and the limits of my own perspective and the places where it felt uncomfortable or hard or sometimes impossible for me to do. So, you know, one of the aspects of gendered experience that I write about in the last chapter of the book is gendered experiences that are spiritual. So people can understand their gender as inherently spiritual or as a spiritual experience and not really a gendered experience. You know, it looks gendered to me because I have my gender glasses on from the UK, but it's not in fact gendered in the way that they understand it. And it is it is really difficult for me to just sit here and say, well, this person became a man through a prophecy, because that's not something that I kind of empathize with or understand. But it's essential for me to write it on their own terms in a way that honors the fact that it's true for them, even if it doesn't make sense to me. And I suppose the other thing I really wanted to do with the book was to try as far as I could to use it for anti-racist purposes. So to not only tell these stories on their own cultural terms rather than through Western goggles, where I say, oh, these people are kind of non-binary and these people are kind of trans women or whatever. Didn't want to do that. But also to say, well, look, if we look at, for example, the reason we think about biological sex as binary today, actually, the process of us coming to think like that was a racist process, a eugenicist process. And our constructs of how we think about biology today oppress some bodies more than others. And those bodies are bodies of color. And so that also felt to me like a way of using the platform that I'd got for as much anti-racist good as I could within the context, I guess.
Yeah. I'm also curious about, your... in terms of your own gender identity and your own experience, how does that, how do you bring that experience to the work, or what do you personally get out of it doing this history?
That's kind of the origin story of the book in a way, because I came to understanding of my own queer identity through identification with the queer past, really. I didn't have particularly many, growing up, I didn't have particularly many people of the same experience who I could relate to, but I did know that I felt an incredibly deep sense of community with queer masculinity in the past. And it took a long time for me to work out what that was about. For a while I was like, maybe I believe in past lives and that's what this is. Only when I discovered what transness was, did I figure out what was going on for me. But that meant that it's always felt incredibly personal and important to me, and that's really the reason why the book is also about what emotional connection to history can kind of do for us, why it's okay not to be a historian who's ruthlessly objective and detached from their subject, and how actually no one is like that. And if we
Even the objective historians, they're covering up that they're getting something personal out of it. They've got some little hobby horse they're riding, or some little wish in their heart that they're seeing in history always.
I genuinely believe that. And particularly, even if what you're emotionally committed to is the idea that we shouldn't have emotions, that in itself is a feeling.
Right.
The people who tell us that history shouldn't be political, and we should leave all the statues up of people who committed awful harms in the past. Those people are having a lot of feelings about history, right? Yes. You can tell by the way they talk.
Yes, they are. Yeah, it's inherently personal. History is also, unless you're just recounting every event that ever occurred, which is impossible, you're always telling a story. And a story always has a point and something to communicate if it's a good story. It is a beginning, middle, and end. It has a character. It has a fucking story. It's a story. Yeah. There's no and that means that it is meant to work on the emotions to some degree, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, this is what my first book was about how the medieval king Edward II got his queer reputation. Turns out it wasn't by people telling the facts. It was by people trying to tell really, really good stories. But that's another story entirely. But absolutely. And what you're also deciding when you're crafting a historical narrative is whose narrative you're telling, right? And what you're leaving out and whose perspective you're coming at it from.
Right.
And none of that is objective, ever.
Well, one story to sort of round us out here that I'd love you to tell that I just thought was... honestly, the most entertaining story in the book was what happened in internment camps in World War I and the communities that formed there. I found it so fascinating. Can you tell us a brief version of that one?
This is really the other origin story of the book. This is where I started thinking about these issues. And this is when I found out about what happened in Nokelo internment camp on the Isle of Man, and subsequently in lots of other internment and prisoner of war camps, which is that these were camps that were just for people assigned male at birth. But there were people who lived as women for the full 4 years within those camps. And what I mean by that is they used women's names, they were called by she, her pronouns, they dressed as women. And historians have looked at this in the past and said, oh, well, they were doing this because they were playing female roles on the stage because there were theatres within these camps. But it's one thing to play a female role on the stage. It's another to get off the stage and keep the dress on and keep the wig on and keep the name. And this is incredibly widespread in any all assigned male at birth camp that you have within the First or Second World Wars. It's incredibly widespread that the kind of normal rules of society get suspended. And there's this opportunity that opens up for people to live as a gender different from the one they were assigned at birth. And given the incredibly widespread nature of it, what that tells me is probably some people were doing it for a laugh. Probably some people were doing it for theatrical purposes. Possibly, probably some people were doing it because it enabled them to sort of sleep with men with more impunity, to feel sort of straight while sleeping with men. And probably some people were doing it because that was how they felt most comfortable living. And we can acknowledge all those possibilities existing simultaneously within these camps.
And these were internment camps for during World War One for on the Isle of Man. Who was interned here
on the Isle of Man? This is a really kind of untold scandal of British history, I think. Who they were interning were not prisoners of war. They were civilians from quote unquote enemy countries who were assigned male at birth and of military age and had been present in the UK when the war broke out. So some of these people were just on holiday and they got rounded up. Some of them had families that had been there since the 17th century. They just never kind of got citizenship. They rounded them all up and they locked them all up. And so it was a mix of, you know, German nationals, Turkish nationals, etc., who were in these camps. But yeah, really important to say they were not combatants. They were civilians who were locked up.
And I think what I love about this story so much is that you imagine some of these people finding some freedom in this situation of unjust imprisonment. They're being imprisoned in a time of war. They're like, why the fuck am I in here? Right. But at the same time, for some of those people, they have the opportunity to be themselves in a way or to find a mode of expression that they did not have before in the sort of, you know, little jury-rigged society that springs up inside of this camp. I don't know. It's just it's a very beautiful image. I'm sure many things about it were not beautiful, very much so. But I can't help but find myself smiling when I think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's another one of those stories of kind of finding resilience in places that you wouldn't expect people to find resilience, right? And finding agency in situations where they had so much agency stripped from them. But actually, this was an opportunity that perhaps they never would have got on the outside.
Yes, it feels like this would make a good movie. That's I'm picturing the sort of like coming out around Christmas time, sort of we've got a combo. There's something for dad with the, you know, with the war setting and everything. But then also dad can go with his queer kid because there's a really wonderful little narrative of, you know, queer resilience in this story somehow.
I would watch the heck out of that, honestly.
I'm here in LA. Maybe I'll take a couple pitches on it. I don't know. What happened to these folks after the, you know, they left the camp?
Mostly we don't know, which is incredibly tragic. So, you know, I'd love to know how many of them continued living in the way that they did in the camps, how many of them didn't, how they felt about that. We have one account of one diarist who did not live as a woman in the camp, but who observed people who did. And he bumped into one of them and he said, oh, and he didn't seem to care to be reminded of it. And that's such a tantalizing thing. You know, was it that he was embarrassed? Was it that it was like a painful memory because he'd enjoyed it a lot, actually, and didn't kind of want to be reminded that he couldn't have it anymore? You know, what was going on for that person? But they also kind of, in a way, the only kind of silver lining of not knowing is that it forces us to think, okay, well, given that we don't know, what if none of them did continue living as women afterwards for a whole variety of reasons? Does that mean that, you know, this isn't an interesting story? Does this mean that this isn't part of trans history? And I don't think it does, because we still, again, have an example of people showing that gender can have absolutely nothing to do with your body. and can be fluid and can be something that you can change. And that's still an incredibly important piece of history, even if it did only last for 4 years for every single one of them, you know?
Yeah, maybe some of these people were like, no, that was just in the camps, man. Like, that was just, I was just doing that for 4 years. I had a nice time. But, you know, now I'm back in London and that's not me anymore. And even that is an interesting, you know, history of gender nonconformity, even if that's just somebody's something somebody dips into for a couple of years in their life.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, really, that's the future I want to work towards, right? Where people can just dip into that for a couple of years in their life and then they stop and it's no big deal. And people don't go, oh, my God, you regretted it. You were wrong. We have to make sure you're really sure before you're allowed to do it. No, just let people play. Just let people do the things and treat it as low stakes and it'll be fine. And, you know, that's kind of great.
Yeah. Do you feel that, look, the cultural climate with all of these issues is so hostile in so many places right now, both in the UK and in the US where I am. But at the same time, I feel that I've seen your book get a lot of traction. You know, I came across it because, as I was telling you before the interview, it was just suggested to me by my, you know, by my audiobook service I was using. I've seen it on out on the table in bookshops. You know, it seems like people are, there's an appetite for this history despite the sometimes, you know, inimical environment. How do you feel about the way things are going in terms of our, you know, ideas about gender in this history?
I've been really, really kind of overwhelmed by the fact that people really seem to have seized on the book, and that I've had so many lovely messages from trans people who felt really seen by it, who've felt like their messy experience of gender wasn't something they'd seen reflected in history before. It's been so lovely to hear that. And I think the more people who are equipped with the knowledge that it has always been the case that we can just play around with gender and that there can be low stakes and the world doesn't implode if we do that, the better. I think rigid categories and rigid power structures never disappear without a backlash. And I think that is what we're seeing. One of the reasons for this backlash is that male and female have never been just identity categories. They've always been power categories. People are really, really afraid of the dissolution of those power categories. But it will come. It will change. And the fact that so many people have felt seen by this book gives me a bit of hope around that as well.
Well, and what your book makes me think about is that, you know, throughout history around the world, people's ideas of gender were very different than the ones we have today, that they were not so rigid in so many other places. And that makes me realize, oh, the rigidity and the backlash that I've grown up with is not mandatory. It's not part of human life. It is just something that's happening right here and now. And so there's the opportunity to have a more open and inclusive view that a lot of us are working to build. And we can have it. Very much reminds me of the book Dawn of Humanity by David Graeber and David Wengrow that we've talked about on the show before. That was a work of anthropology about how humanity had so many different other forms of government than we have right now. So many different other ways of understanding, you know, social relations and hierarchy and power relations, that it increases your understanding of what possibility is. And your book did the same thing for me. And I think it's really beautiful. And thank you so much for coming on the show to talk to us about it.
Thank you so much. That's totally wonderful to hear. And I've really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Well, the book again is called Before We Were Trans. Folks can pick it up at our special bookshop, factuallypod.com/books. Where else can people find it, Kit, or where can they find your work?
Have a look at my website, kithayam.com. I am also on, not to dead name anything in this conversation, but Twitter.
That's the first time I've heard that referred to as a dead name, and it's very funny to me. Please be respectful of Elon. Let's not dead name his service, okay? That's not kind to him.
He wouldn't be kind to me if he met me, so I think, you know, quid pro quo. I'm on that social media site for as long as it exists. Find me there if you like.
Great. Wonderful. Under the username Kit Hayam, I assume.
Absolutely. And Instagram too. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for being here, Kit. It's been wonderful.
Thanks so much for having me.
My God, thank you once again to Kit for coming on the show. If you want to pick up a copy of their incredible book that I cannot recommend highly enough, head to factuallypod.com/books. I know you're going to love it. If you want to support this show, you can do so on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/AdamConover. $5 a month gets you every episode of this podcast ad-free. For $15 a month, I will read your name at the end of this podcast and put it in the credits of all of my video monologues. This week, I want to thank Brennan Peterman, Ultra Czar, Busy Bee, Josh Davies, Lois Bell, and Amet A. Thank you so much for your support of the show. Of course, I always want to thank our producers, Tony Wilson and Sam Roudman, everybody here at HeadGum for making this show possible. You can find me online at adamconover.net. You can also find my tour dates there. Once again, I'm going to Arlington, Virginia, Nashville, Atlanta, DC, New York, Philadelphia, Portland, Maine. I think I forgot a few. So head to adamconover.net to see all my tickets and tour dates. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time on Factually.
That was a HeadGum podcast.